the topic today, and what we're going to do, I need to make one other correction about our program. Lynn, I've got it here. Lynn Uzel is changing October 1st. She will be with the Veritas Fund on postdoctoral research fellow at the John Marshall Center for the Study of Statesmanship in the Jessup School of Leadership Studies at the University of Richmond. Got that? I work at a place called Lyon College. There are no commas or semicolons in that. But anyway, she told me that since they're the ones funding her attending this conference, I needed to make sure you were aware of that. So at this point, I'll invite her to the podium.
Thank you. I should say that the original title I had in mind for this talk was Demagoguery, Constitutional Barriers, and Technological Breakthroughs. And the first problem with that title was that in this Twitter generation, anything that cannot fit on like a license plate is too long. And the second problem is that even though I wanted to emphasize the idea of the breakthroughs in the barriers as well as the barriers themselves, I don't think all of these breakthroughs were actually technological. So the title that I finally settled on was The Founders' Firewall Against Demagoguery, because I think probably everyone in this room is familiar with your computer's firewall, and you know that if it is not updated every few hours, then your computer is left vulnerable to all the hostile forces which are trying to breach the firewall. So that title then at least gets at both of these ideas of the founders' intentions for the Constitution as being a barrier to demagoguery, and also the many ways in which those barriers were compromised over time, if not immediately. So the first thing that I want to point out is an interesting bit of trivia, which is that demagogues are mentioned exactly twice in the Federalist Papers. Hamilton mentions it in the first Federalist paper, in which he talks about there being two sides to this question and the possibility of demagogues on each side. And in the last Federalist paper, when he talks about the necessity of creating stable government sooner rather than later to avoid the possibility of anarchy and despotism and demagoguery. And so you can say that the Federalist Papers begins and ends with a warning against demagoguery. And although the entirety of the Federalist Papers is not about demagoguery, there's not even a single Federalist paper you can point to say that's the one that treats of demagoguery or rhetoric. Nonetheless, reading the framers and the founders is a lesson in the virtues of good rhetoric and the threats of demagoguery. Now, the framers, if you follow the convention debates, spoke frequently about demagogues, pretended patriots, designing men, bad men who intrigue themselves into office, and Elbridge Gerry mentioned that demagogues are the great pests of our government. Demagoguery was frequently brought up during the Constitutional Convention, and the founders were often seeking ways of preventing the preeminence of demagoguery in America, both through preventative measures, removing those conditions in which demagoguery thrives, and also by instituting more positive means of deliberation and rhetoric. And so both of those are the subjects of today's talk. But before we get to that, we need to define our terms. What is demagoguery? If you follow the many instances in which the framers talk about demagogues, it is pretty safe to say that demagoguery is an effective and persuasive speaker who is arguing on the opposite side of the one who's complaining about demagoguery. And that may sound glib, but it's a pretty consistent definition that will apply to most of instances. In fact, in that Federalist Number 1, Hamilton warns that history will teach us that the specious mask of zeal for the rights of the people has been found a much more certain road to the introduction of despotism than a zeal for the firmness and efficiency of government, and that of those men who have overturned the liberties of republics, the greatest number have begun their career by paying an obsequious court to the people, commencing demagogues and ending tyrants. Now, since Hamilton is about to champion efficiency in government and firmness, it is obviously the other side, the ones who are constantly harping about people's rights, that's where you can expect to find the demagogues arising. Nonetheless, if you research more closely, you will find that there are some objective criteria by which one can identify the demagogues. First of all, they have a mass audience. Demagoguery thrives in large audiences. They cannot survive in a small, select group of calm and deliberate men. They require something of a mob. Secondly, they appeal to excessive or inappropriate emotions. Now, as the last speaker had to emphasize, an appeal to emotion by itself is not illegitimate, and the framers didn't think so. They appealed to emotion all the time. And this is one thing that I actually had a great difficulty in convincing my students of rhetoric, that an appeal to an emotion by itself is not illegitimate. In fact, if there's no even implicit appeal to emotion, it's not rhetorical discourse. But the framers were very fearful of excessive emotions and inappropriate emotions. They spoke about the passions, inordinate sentiment, inappropriate sentiment. In Aristotle, he points out that envy and indignation are the same emotion. Their only difference is the object towards which they are addressed. Envy is outrage at the deserved good fortune of someone else, whereas indignation is outrage at undeserved good fortune. If a rhetor tries to inflame somebody's envy, that is always wrong. If he is trying to stir people to righteous indignation, then he is simply doing the job of a good statesman. And that gets us to the next feature of the demagogue. The demagogue is the one who advocates vicious or imprudent ends, popular measures over measures that are for the common good. And this is where we get to the cause of always assuming that demagogues are from the other party. Because the speaker, of course, is advocating for the public good. The one who is arguing on the other side must be the demagogue because he is advocating something which is vicious or imprudent. And so it has a basis in objective reality, but the way that it's going to be applied is always going to be a subjective. But so long as we can agree on what the common good is, we can agree on who the real demagogues are. And if we try to decide amongst us who was the greatest demagogue of the 20th century, and we start naming Clinton, Reagan, FDR, a people's determination is going to be based largely not only on the success of the speaker, but also on the measures he was trying to pursue. Finally, a demagogue has a pretended zeal for the good of the audience, but a real interest in his own aggrandizement. You can see that in the first Federalist paper, Hamilton talks about people commencing demagogues. They end tyrants. Demagoguery is not an end in itself, and it's not a means only to the end which the speaker is trying to encourage. The end is the personal aggrandizement of the speaker. And therefore, we get to one of the first ways of preventing demagoguery. Now, Washington, immediately after he started attending the Constitutional Convention, had to write a letter to Lafayette explaining why he was drawn into politics again, after giving so many assurances that he was in perpetual retirement. If men did not heed this call to duty, then the alternative would not be no government at all, but rather a plan of government, quote, dictated perhaps by some aspiring demagogue who will not consult the interests of his country so much as his own ambitious views. If statesmen do not step forward with the pursuit of the common good, then the demagogues will fill the vacuum. So, how did the framers seek to prevent demagoguery? The first instance should already be seen from this, that they needed to institute a stable government. Demagoguery arises out of anarchy and crisis. A lot of the framers believed that Americans were on the point of anarchy. One of the things to prevent demagoguery was to institute a constitution which would make the people feel secure and would obviate the need of some popular leader who would inflame the passions of the people. The next way is the next form was the familiar argument in Federalist 10. The enlarged sphere, of course, was to prevent a majority faction. Now, there's many causes for faction, but one of the causes of faction was the threat of demagoguery. Not only was it a zeal for different opinions concerning religion or politics, but it was an attachment to different leaders ambitiously contending for preeminence and power, or to persons of other descriptions whose fortunes have been interesting to the human passions. By enlarging the sphere of government, these aspiring demagogues are left without the means of practicing their art. So Madison is here suggesting that there is a sort of middle ground which is the ideal audience for the demagogue. They do not thrive in small audiences, but they also cannot thrive in an enlarged sphere. As each representative will be chosen by a greater number of citizens in the large than in the small republic, it will be more difficult for unworthy candidates to practice with success the vicious arts by which elections are too often carried. So one of the first questions is, has mass media destroyed this barrier? The physical limitations that Madison was talking about a demagogue not being able to reach an audience too large, has that been subverted by mass media? The second means of undermining demagogues is the election of the presidency. Now, when I was lecturing at Montpelier, over the summer about the Constitution, I had one surly gentleman insist that I defend this piece of garbage, the Electoral College. And the problem is that the Electoral College never worked exactly as it was intended. If you understand that what the framers were trying to do was trying to make the presidency an office that would be independent of any body that they could corrupt, then the Electoral College was, in fact, a work of genius. The framers considered an election by the people, by either or both houses of the Congress, by state legislatures, by state executives, candidates chosen by lot from the legislature, and then like a college of cardinals, they couldn't leave the room until they had chosen one of the ones that had been chosen by lot. And as a sign of their desperation, Governor Morris said, let's not dismiss this idea too fast. They thought of every possible permutation. They chose the Electoral College because it would be a body that nobody would ever know who would make up its members, and so it could not be corrupted either by the small arts of bribery in a small pool or by the demagogic arts. And finally, they sought to remove the threat of demagoguery by instituting this bicameral legislature. Now, as you know, the primary political virtue is prudence. And prudence presupposes moral virtue, but it also includes an extensive knowledge of particulars and great foresight, a knowledge of appropriate means to chosen ends. The framers did not believe that they could form a body of prudent men, but they did think that they could approximate prudence by instituting two very different houses of Congress that brought their own virtues to bear on every piece of legislation. And so the House would be that body which would bring particular knowledge of local circumstances. They would sympathize with the feelings and bring with them the same beliefs as their constituents. However, they would also bring all of the passions of the people. The Senate, on the other hand, would bring with them wisdom, foresight, and greater prudence, greater moral virtue. But they would be somewhat removed from the people. It is by combining these two and making sure that no law is passed except by the agreement of both of these bodies that they instituted a kind of prudent deliberation in their rhetoric. Now, as you know, first of all, through the 17th Amendment, the Senate is no longer chosen in the way that Madison wanted with these successive filtrations, which was going to strain out the detritus of the passions of the people, and also through the greater and greater enlarged sphere of the federal government. The representatives no longer represent 30 or 40,000 people, but instead represent 500,000 people. And so they also don't have the particular knowledge that they once had. So in both of these ways, the framers' intentions were overthrown. So the other, I had a few other ways in which I was going to discuss the modern media, but I'll leave that to the other speakers who are probably going to discuss it at greater length than I would have.